Here on the book of Isaiah, and so we're going to continue that. If you haven't gotten the packets of information, there's still some on the back table, kind of painting the context of when we're talking about and giving the verses where you can find the passages on the kings that were reigning when Isaiah was giving his prophecy. So just as a way of reminder, Isaiah prophesied, you see this at the bottom, Isaiah prophesied during the reigns of four kings of Judah. Isaiah, also known as Azariah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And so that's the time period, when we're reading through these, that's the time period that is going on. And a lot of these events on the timeline, either Isaiah is going to mention and talk about, or they just occur. And so you know that that's happening in the background of Isaiah's prophecies. But make sure you look over that information that's in the packets and kind of familiarize yourself with that. I want, though, to look at these four kings, and the reign of these four kings, and look at what the morality of the nation of Judah is, during the reign of these four kings. Uzziah was an extremely righteous king. I mean, he was a great king. And you can read in Kings and especially in Chronicles where it describes just how great Uzziah's reign was. He was faithful to the Lord, and because of that, he just was exceedingly prosperous. I mean, Judah militarily did amazing, and they just, you know, reaped the spoils of war and were just this incredible, incredibly prosperous nation under the reign of Uzziah. And so he was very righteous. Now the people, I think there's not a lot of details, really talked about, in Kings and Chronicles. I think the people during the reign of Uzziah were righteous. However, we're going to look in a second about maybe what happened that kind of altered that. But in general, I mean, Uzziah reigned for 50-something years. During that reign, I mean, just a great time in Israel, very prosperous. And one of the reasons why I think the people were righteous, Uzziah himself is being taught by a prophet named Zechariah, not the Zechariah that the book of Zechariah is by, but there is a prophet named Zechariah that teaches Uzziah the right things. And so it seems like with a righteous king, with a righteous prophet, that the people would be righteous, especially because they're very successful in all that they do. The problem comes when Uzziah gets that successful and then gets prideful. And it's actually kind of a shocking situation when you read about it in Chronicles. But we won't read the whole thing, but, you know, it says about Uzziah, his fame spread far, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. This is after the description of just, he's won all these battles, they have all this stuff, everything's amazing, he's just got this great reputation, he's so strong, and then the next line, but when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction. For he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. He got really proud after all these years of success. And we're not gonna look into the story and read it. But he decided he's gonna burn incense in the temple of God. And one of the reasons that makes me think that the people during this time in general were righteous is because 80 priests stood against Uzziah and said, "You're not gonna do this." So he's confronted by 80 priests, which is an amazing thing that these 80 priests would say, "I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're the king of Judah. I don't care how much success you've had. God said the king was not the one to burn the incense in the temple. We are. You are not going to do this." And say they withstand Uzziah. And probably since the priests are so influential, they're in charge of teaching the laws. They're the ones that are in charge of facilitating these sacrifices. Probably then the people of Israel would have been very righteous at this time. The sad thing is, it seems like maybe once this incident with Uzziah happens, God strikes him with leprosy. And so for the rest of his life, for the last few years of his life, he is a leper and he's living in a different place. He's isolated because he's considered unclean. His son Jotham is gonna rule in his place. I mean, Uzziah is still the king, but Jotham is in charge of everything since Uzziah is a leper. And what's interesting is Jotham's described as very righteous. He's described as a righteous king. The people, though, there's not a lot of details given, but it seems like there's been a transition now. Because when it talks about Jotham in 2 Chronicles 27, it says, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah had done, except he did not enter the temple of the Lord. But the people still followed corrupt practices. And that's an interesting line because that's all it says, but okay, the people aren't necessarily strictly holding to the law. It says they still followed corrupt practices. So probably that means that started when Jotham was kind of reigning for his father, when his father was a leper, and maybe even a little before that. So all of that to say, it really could have been that Uzziah's act of defiance, when he goes into the temple and he says, I'm the king, I'm going to burn this incense, that act of defiance perhaps was a catalyst that kind of trickled down and, you know, the king didn't care as much about the laws and he was severely punished. But then you get to the time of his son and his son's righteous, but the people aren't. Some are. I don't think that line means that just nobody was righteous, just tons of wickedness. But probably what's happening is they're sacrificing at the high places, which is where a lot of sacrifice to pagan gods took place up on hills and mountains and stuff. So that's going on and maybe some other stuff. So it kind of, maybe the immorality started to trickle out. And so it seems possibly like during the time of Jotham, there's righteous people, there's unrighteous people. Some have kind of started to maybe follow the example of Uzziah, not really stick as strictly to God's law as they should. Worship on the high places is starting to really just be super common. And that's going to then lead to Ahaz. And Ahaz is absolutely unrighteous. He's not a righteous guy. And the people are not righteous under his reign. And so it seems like maybe Jotham was that transition period where during Uzziah's time, righteous, prosperous, Uzziah makes a very crucial error. Just a rebellious act. Under Jotham, things are okay, not really as great as they should be, but then under Ahaz, things are terrible. Isaiah is gonna have to then, confront Ahaz and really try and persuade him to follow God, and he's not going to. And then you get to the reign of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah is absolutely righteous. One of the amazing things about Hezekiah is not just that he was righteous, but that he was righteous, he wasn't perfect though. And the book of Isaiah really kind of brings that out, that Hezekiah chose God and put his faith in God, but Hezekiah struggled and he had some doubts and he even made some decisions at times where he was going to trust in what was physical and what he could see over God who he couldn't see. And ultimately he is extremely righteous, but we do see some weaknesses in him that really make him somebody we can identify with, I think. It's not just like Hezekiah, perfect, and then move on. I mean, Hezekiah made some very human errors. Ultimately, though, he's extremely righteous, and he brings about this major spiritual reform. During the time of Hezekiah, things are just amazing, and there's just this huge description during his reign of all the amazing things he did. He got rid of this, and he got rid of this, and he got rid of this, and he brought this in and did this. I mean, really making these huge reforms. And that was a high point for the people of Israel, that they, you know, during that time, they were very righteous. And, you know, when we look at this, it doesn't mean that, you know, there's nobody unrighteous. And it doesn't mean the righteousness lasted. I mean, once a king died, it was pretty easy for the people to be swayed into, whatever the next king was into. But in general, this is kind of the moral context that Isaiah is going to have to deal with. Isaiah is going to be prophesying during the reigns of these four kings. He's going to start in the very last year of Uzziah's life, like we said on Sunday. So the very end, which seems to me, maybe that's because that's when things really started to digress. Maybe people started to kind of have the same attitude as Isaiah did about God's laws. And so maybe that's why Isaiah kind of comes on the scene right then. But that's kind of what we're looking at. Any thoughts or any questions on that at all? Yeah.
It seems...
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's like, and what we read on Sunday, God just doesn't care about all the things they're doing if they're going to do it without love toward God. If they're just going to do the actions and there's no heart in there and there's no obedience to God, it's just doing the actions, he doesn't want it. But if you're going to do it, he expects it to be done correctly. So he doesn't want it if there's no heart, if there's actually no care about God, if it's just physical things. But if you're going to do the things he wants you to do, he says, I said do it this way, do it this way. So yeah, that's a great thing. Yeah.
And what happened to the people when the leadership was not good. And the point that the Lord put in there about Joseph, that he was a good guy, but he didn't go to the house of the Lord.
Mm.
So he was not a leader in their service to God. He was a pretty good guy himself, but he just wasn't a leader in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right, is that his morality is not enough if he's not taking responsibility for what he's supposed to be in charge of. I'm supposed to be in charge of, as the king, not just my own morality and service to God, but what about those people that I am reigning over? And yeah, I think you're right. He didn't take action to ensure that, and so, of course, then that leads to what happens with Ahaz. Any other thoughts on that? All right. Well, I know the book of Isaiah is very intimidating. I mean, it's intimidating to me too. These 66 chapters. There's different ways to break up the book. I'm not completely sold on like one specific way, but I think in general, Isaiah can be broken into maybe two sections with kind of a middle section that links them together. The first 37 chapters really focus on Assyria and the rise of Assyria, and what are these kings going to do in response to Assyria, and what are the people going to do, but also highlighting God bringing forth this king to lead them and to reestablish Jerusalem, to cleanse Jerusalem, to save Jerusalem. So we're gonna focus on that with me. Once Steve starts teaching, he's going to do the chapters 40 through 66. But kind of right in the middle of those sections, you do have the story of King Hezekiah. It's a narrative. It's no longer the poetry. And it's the story of him in dealing with the Assyrians and their attack. It's the story of him dealing with his own sickness and God healing him. It's the story of him dealing with his pride over maybe making alliances with Babylon so that maybe they can help him And all of that, I think, is kind of a link between the books. That link, chapters 38 and 39, really kind of deal with Assyria a little bit, but then also look forward to Babylon. And then chapters 40 through 66 deal with Babylon, but it's more about, not Babylon attacking, it's more about they've already attacked, and you're going to be in captivity. And it's going to be horrible, but here's what God's going to do. And you're going to come out of captivity. And really emphasis on this servant. You know, we're pretty familiar with Isaiah 53, the description of this servant and how much he suffered. And we read that at the Lord's Supper table a lot because it very clearly is showing a picture of Jesus. But then also there's this language of God conquering, you know, not just a servant, but just somebody that conquers and defeats. So anyway, that maybe can give us a little bit of a clear delineation in the book. It's not just 66 chapters straight and there's kind of no breaks. The focus does tend to or seem to change kind of at 38, 39 and on. So if you don't, you know, if you're going to tackle the book, if you want to just kind of focus on the first 37 chapters at first, that would be good, and then kind of move on. But you know, I don't want anybody trying to, I'll just read the whole book, and you know, it can be very intimidating. So with that in mind, let's look back at chapter 1. We read chapter 1 on Sunday, and God is very displeased. And like I said on Sunday, chapters 1 through 5 really are an introduction to the book. At least it appears to me it is. That it's just kind of general prophecies about Jerusalem and Judah. But then chapter 6, we're gonna read about when Isaiah became a prophet. And then after that, the prophecies get more specific as to like when they took place. But 1 through 5 really introduces us to God's feelings about Judah and Jerusalem. And as we read on Sunday, he's absolutely displeased. He says that they've rebelled against him. They don't know him. They're a nation that's laden with iniquity. They deal corruptly. They've forsaken the Lord. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. They're utterly estranged. And he tells them, you know, you're suffering because of that. It's not just that you're wicked. You're suffering. He says, you know, why will you be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick. The whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there's no soundness in it. Bruises, sores, raw wounds. Your wounds aren't even, you know, bandaged up. You're a suffering city. You're a suffering group because of your wickedness. Foreigners have attacked, and it's miserable for you. Why do you keep rebelling against me? And one metaphor I think can be challenging for us. In verse 7. In chapter 1, verse 7, it says, your country lies desolate, your cities are burned with fire, in your very presence foreigners devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by foreigners, and the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Alright, well, until I looked this up, I didn't know what a lodge in a cucumber field was. Alright, but this is, you know, a painting of, okay, here's Jerusalem, this, you know, mighty city with amazing walls, just this fortress, that's great. But what God says is, you've rebelled against me, you're being attacked, you're being sieged by these other nations, you're suffering, it's horrible, you're wicked, you're miserable, and you're left like a booth in a vineyard. Like, this is what you are. You know, not something that can withstand anything, not something that's glorious, not something that's, you know, can't be conquered. You know, a child could conquer that. You know, and that's what he's saying. And then the kind of shocking realization, if the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have become like Sodom, become like Gomorrah. The only reason we are not completely destroyed, it's because God allowed there to be some of us that have lived through this. So this is what Isaiah is saying to them, is that, look, it is only because of God's mercy that you aren't gone like the city of Sodom was destroyed and gone, or like Gomorrah was destroyed and gone. It is only because God left some people that you're not completely conquered, Judah. And so just kind of really wanting them to face the fact of what their situation is. Any thoughts at all on anything I've talked about so far?
Is Uzziah the king that comes after Solomon?
Comes after what?
Solomon?
No, no. There's several before him. This is in, it's like this, like the second half of the kings of Judah. Yeah. So, anyone else? Any other thoughts? All right. Well, he goes on to describe, let me see, I'm not sure what I have a slide of. All right. He goes on to describe just how vain their worship is. And we talked about this Sunday. They're doing the sacrifices. You know, they're observing the feasts. They're observing the special days. But they're still acting wickedly. You know, it's like just pointless observance of rituals without any morality. All right, and I made the point that that's very applicable to us, that God doesn't want just observance of physical things with no actual morality, no obedience, no righteousness, just I did it, I did the action. And so he just criticizes that completely and says, you know, you're a people of blood, you're violent, you're dishonest. I don't care if you bring the sacrifice and kill it. You're not caring about what I care about. You're thinking that you can just kind of magically appease me with these physical things. But then it's in verse 18, where he says this, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be eaten by the sword. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken." And I made this point on Sunday again. This is kind of a review. But, you know, out of nowhere, God just makes this proclamation. You'll be purified. You'll be cleansed. Just out of nowhere. And it's, you know, what is it based on? What have the people done to warrant that? Well, nothing. I mean, they're a wicked people that haven't cared about God, but God says, here's an offer, being clean. Here's an offer, being pure. Your blood can be changed and it can be washed away. The violence, the sins, it can be done away with. There's nothing they did to grant them that at all. There's nothing they did to earn that. I think it's a very clear indication of God's grace that you're evil. Here's an offer I have for you. I mean, just, they didn't do anything to cause God to say, well, they did do that. Okay, I'm going to offer them the chance to be white as snow. It's completely God's graciousness. This offer just appears out of nowhere. Now, that doesn't mean they can just sit back and get it, right? That doesn't mean like, oh, he made the offer. We have to do nothing. God says, okay, but that gracious offer I'm giving you only comes if you are willing and obedient. If you're not, you don't get that offer. All right, and so I think we can clearly see the correlation between us and these people, that through nothing we've done, through nothing that, you know, we've accomplished, God offers to us a chance of redemption. He says, here's redemption. No, you didn't do anything to warrant it. It's only my grace that you have this redemption. Here it is. And he says, now, obey me and get it. You know, that's the correlation. And I love the metaphor he uses here. If you're obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. If you refuse and rebel, you shall be eaten by the sword. So it's a really picturesque metaphor that instead of consuming and enjoying the produce from the Lord, instead of eating that, if you rebel, foreigners are going to come and you're going to be eaten by being hacked to pieces by the enemy. So just really picturesque thing he's depicting here. Any, comments on that? All right. Well, then we get into, Isaiah specifically talking about Jerusalem. He calls it the city. That's Jerusalem or Zion. And he's going to describe what the city's like. All right. So, think back to Old Testament books that maybe we're more familiar with, like Exodus or Numbers or Deuteronomy. You know, Jerusalem was the place, he mentioned Jerusalem specifically, but God said he wanted to do what with the people of Israel? That's kind of vague. Say it again. Make a covenant with them, yeah. But him specifically, like he was going to do what? His person, if you will, was going to do what? I know that's a vague, bad question. I know. Just forget I asked the question. That was a dumb question. All right. How about this? He tells them when they're going to go into the promised land, there's going to be a place, and I'm going to do what? Dwell. Yes, that's what I was looking for. Sorry. Dwell among them. Yeah. He's going to dwell among them. He makes that very clear. I'm going to dwell among you. I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. And I'm going to dwell in the midst of you. I'm going to be there. Well, when they get into the promised land and set up this city, Jerusalem's the place where that's chosen by God to dwell. And that's what the temple is a place where God dwells among them, just like he dwelled among them in the tabernacle, as they traveled around. And so that's what Jerusalem was supposed to be. All right, and if we know that, we can appreciate how horrible these next few verses are, because they show the sinfulness of Jerusalem during Isaiah's day. He says, how the faithful city has become a whore. She who was full of justice, a righteousness lodged in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross, your best wine mixed with water. Your princes are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and runs after gifts. They do not bring justice to the fatherless, and the widow's cause does not come to them. Instead of being a faithful wife to God, which is what Jerusalem is supposed to be in this metaphor, instead of being a faithful wife, Jerusalem is this woman that abandons her husband and goes after other lovers, which is what Jerusalem did a lot. They'd go after other gods. They'd go after what the foreigners did. They would seek their prosperity from somewhere else. Now, keep in mind, back in these times especially, I mean, the wife only got her food and the stuff she needed from her husband, because he worked. If he didn't work, she wouldn't receive anything. She wouldn't have the money for food and clothing and all this. So she was so dependent on him for these material things. And for her to say, forget my husband, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna, you know, sleep with this man over here and he'll give me the things that I need. That's what Jerusalem's being accused of doing. God says, instead of being a faithful city, you've just become a prostitute. You've prostituted yourselves to other gods or maybe not even other gods always. Maybe it's just that, no, we still serve God, but we do whatever we want. And so it's our wants and our desires. That's where we get our prosperity from. And so instead of a wife who's faithful, you have a prostitute. Instead of righteousness being in the city, it's full of murderers. Instead of pure silver, it's just impure, full of impurities. Instead of rich, good wine, it's watered down. Instead of princes who are valiant, moral men, they're rebels and they're friends with thieves. So he's just kind of one by one describing just the morality is just broken down. This was supposed to be a place where God dwelled. God's not going to dwell here. And then he describes the character, how ridiculous they are. Everybody's corrupt. They love bribes. There's no justice. Even for orphans and widows, no justice. They care about money. They care about doing whatever they want. This is the Jerusalem that Isaiah is depicting. And it's a pretty horrible, sad state for Jerusalem. Any thoughts on that? All right, well, God's going to do something. In verse 24, therefore the Lord declares, the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, ah, I will get relief from my enemies and avenge myself on my foes. I will turn my hand against you and I will smelt away your dross as with lye and remove all your alloy, and I will restore your judges as at the first and your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward, you shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. So God's goal is, I'm going to make Jerusalem righteous. They're going to be a faithful city. I'm going to come in and I'm going to purify them. I'm going to cleanse them. I'm going to come in, and it doesn't really sound pleasant either. I'm going to come in and I'm going to make sure that there is not what there is now in Jerusalem, that Jerusalem is faithful. Jerusalem is who they're supposed to be. And so God's going to take action. He's going to fix this, because right now, Judah and Jerusalem, they're just not what they're supposed to be. They've failed. Did I skip a verse? No. Okay. So then he describes what's going to happen. Zion shall be redeemed by justice, and those in her who repent by righteousness. But rebels and sinners shall be broken together, and those who forsake the Lord shall be consumed. For they shall be ashamed of the oaks that you desired, and you shall blush for the gardens that you have chosen. For you shall be like an oak whose leaf withers, and like a garden without water. And the strong shall become tinder, and his work a spark, and both of them shall burn together with none to quench them. God's describing here, you know, I'm going to redeem Zion, but there's going to be those that are not going to be part of my plan. And since they're not going to follow my plan to redeem Zion and make it a city of righteousness, they're going to be destroyed. And he says they're going to be embarrassed or ashamed of the oaks they desired, blush for the gardens you've chosen. That's kind of a vague reference. In chapters 57 and 66, he talks a little bit more specifically about that. One, it's possible the oaks are the trees they used to build idols, that they carve idols out of. But also, there were pagan cult practices where you would go to the gardens to fornicate in honor of the gods. And you would go in the woods and in the gardens to eat, he talks about in chapter 66, to eat pig flesh and mice, you know, in honor of these cult pagan practices. And so that's what they're yearning for. These people in Judah. And what God says is, you know, when I come and I restore things, you're going to be embarrassed for the things you used to be tempted by, for the things you gave into, the sinful things you did. You're going to be ashamed of those when I come and I restore, restore Judah and Jerusalem. He makes a play off that. You know, you used to be tempted to go to the oak trees to engage in ritual fornication in honor of the gods. You're going to be an oak, and you're going to be an oak that withers, an oak tree that withers. And you used to like to go to the gardens for these cult practices. You're going to be like a garden that's without water and just dried up. And he says, the strong shall become tinder. So those you think are mighty are going to be like tinder. And what they're doing is going to be like a spark. And if you got tinder and you got a spark, it just burns everything up. And he says, that's what's going to happen to you. That all the work of these mighty people that think they're so great and rebel against God, it's all going to be destroyed because I, God, am coming to redeem my city and to make my city what it's supposed to be. Any thoughts on up to verse 31? All right, well, we get into chapter 2, and there's a description of the mountain of the house of the Lord. All right, and so we're still talking here about Jerusalem that's on the mountain where the temple is. And this description describes, it's these people that are flowing to this mountain. There, God has redeemed Jerusalem, and all these people are coming to it. They're coming to it. And it's not just Israelites. All the nations flow to it. Many peoples shall come. And they say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. This description is just this beautiful depiction of there's God's Jerusalem. It's on this hill. It's beautiful, and people come to it because that's where God is. And they come to it to hear from God and to learn from God and to appreciate God and for him to be their God. That's where they come. Well, all of this, the last part of chapter 1 and then now into chapter 2, it's describing this city. It's describing this place. But when we get to the New Testament, the New Testament writers make it clear, this is what the church is. The church is Jerusalem, the real Jerusalem, the real Jerusalem that's been redeemed. God redeemed it. This group of people is redeemed by God. And people come here. All right, they're part of this. They come here, that's where God is. They flow to it. People from all over, all different nations flow to this. It's not restricted to just one nationality. It's just worldwide, people come to Jesus' church that's been redeemed. And no more is it about fighting nation against nation, but the people that come here about peace. Their swords have been turned into farm tools for harvesting and for reaping. And there's not war among the church. The church is a people of peace. And that's what the Hebrew writer talks about. We don't have time to look at it, but in Hebrews 12, he says to them, you've come to Mount Zion. You've come to that city of God. And then in looking at these two chapters of Isaiah, if we read that and then we go and read Revelation 21, we see the ultimate depiction of Jerusalem. Not the Jerusalem in the Old Testament that just failed and just was maybe righteous, but then just went downhill and it just wasn't what it should be. Not a Jerusalem that God didn't want to dwell in. In Revelation 21, we read about the Jerusalem from heaven that we are at right now, but to our fullest extent, one day we'll be there. And that will be God's Jerusalem. And that will be where God dwells. And the angels will cry out, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man here in Jerusalem. And that's the beautiful picture that Revelation is describing, that one day God's people who are redeemed now in these days in the church will reach their fullest glorification where they literally are in the presence of God with Jesus together as this holy city of Jerusalem. So the depiction of Jerusalem in Isaiah is really this corrupted, skewed version of what it's supposed to be. Because God makes it clear in the New Testament documents, the real Jerusalem is my people here, my church, my kingdom. And I will bring them into this gloried state one day when I decide. And so as we read these chapters of Isaiah, make sure you go and read through Hebrews 12 and Revelation 21. And you'll see the events I'm talking about. And it really makes a strong impression of what God was doing with Jerusalem. Because a lot of times it's like, well, there's a city of Jerusalem, there's a temple there. None of that matters anymore. It's all gone. Nothing to do with us. We're not Jews. And, you know, we don't see the correlation there. So make sure you read through those chapters in the New Testament and really see the correlation between the Jerusalem that is during Isaiah's time and the Jerusalem that is now and is to come. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This summer, myself, Jesse Roy, and my girlfriend Tess Clem, I think some of you know her, went kayaking back in June. We took a Saturday and went out to Adams, Tennessee, on the Red River, if anyone cared to know where we were. It was a good place. And if you've been kayaking, it's a lot of fun. And something happened that Saturday that was kind of a funny story. And looking back at it, I kind of realized there were some good analogies and applications that we could apply, or I could try to apply tonight to our spiritual lives as Christians. So I kind of want to set the stage and tell that story and just get some simple applications out of that. So, again, it was a Saturday. We're out in the water. We ended up kind of getting ahead of everyone else so we could just be the three of us and just kind of do what we wanted to. And if you've been kayaking, like I said, it's a lot of fun. There's some cool things to do. If the river has any rapids in it or anything like that, that can always be fun. If there's wildlife around, it's fun to watch that. Different scenery. But sometimes it can get a little bit boring. When there's no turns in the river, there's just a straight stretch. The scenery might get a little bit boring. There's no birds or animals around to look at. And so that's when I kind of get a little bit restless and I try to figure out something to do. And that's oftentimes when I do something kind of dumb. But so when we're going, there'll be different things that during those stretches, you might like, I might wander over to the bank, or if there's a limb hanging over the river, I might want to like row under the river, I mean, under the limb. There's nothing special, but it's just something to mix it up, try to do something. And a lot of times that backfires. Going under a limb, might run into a spider web, something like that. So a lot of times it backfires, but I don't really learn my lesson. And so one of these times, a lot of times there's a little island maybe in the river, not really like an island, but just some reeds kind of growing up. And so that might split the river in a couple different ways. And so one of the things I like to do is take the one that's maybe a little bit narrower or has, again, maybe a limb hanging over it, just trying to change it up. And so one of these came up and there was an obvious right section of the river that was obviously shallow enough and wide enough for us all to go through. And so we were all going that way. And then I saw at the last second, a little tiny little stream on the left side of this little island. And I was like, I'm going to go do that. So I went over there and within about 10 seconds, I had run aground on some rocks. And usually when I had done that, which was probably about the 100th time that day, I can kind of take my paddle and get off of those. But I could tell that there was shallow rocks for another probably 100 feet. And so I ended up having to stand up and started dragging my kayak. And Jesse and Tess were already going and just kind of pointing and laughing and make fun of me already. But didn't obviously stop to help at all because, I don't know, they didn't. And so I started to stand up and then I realized there was a bunch of water in my kayak. And if you've been kayaking, a lot of times there's a hole in the bottom of the kayak to get, or not the bottom, obviously, but like the edge, I guess, to get the water out. And so, but you have to like stand up and get the kayak and almost tip it upside down to try to get the water out of that hole. And so I started to do that, and then I put it back in the water, and I don't know how, but it got filled up again before I got back in it. So I had to do this twice, and people started coming down the river and were, like, also pointing and laughing at me. So it was kind of a big debacle. In the meantime, I'd set my paddle down in the river, because that's what you're supposed to do in that situation. And it was, of course, gone by that point, because it was, like, 15 minutes later. So then I didn't know where my paddle was, and so I had to proceed to, like, doggy paddle on my kayak, which was also very funny to look at. And then I was very stressed out because I knew if I went past my paddle, I was not going to be able to doggy paddle back upstream. So I was making sure I found my paddle and went over to it. Eventually, I found my paddle on a bank and caught up to Jesse and Tess. And obviously, they pretended like they didn't know what was going on. They're like, what happened, dude? What was going on? And so, anyways, that's the kind of story. And I think there's a couple different things that I thought were kind of applicable to us as Christians. And as I go over this, it's going to sound like I'm bashing Jesse and Tess a lot for not doing what they're supposed to do. This was not a very stressful scene. I was not going to drown or anything. So as I go through this, don't go up to Jesse afterwards and like make fun of him and stuff, because that's not what I'm trying to do. But if taking this on a more dramatic scale and applying it to our lives as Christians, there are some things I think we can learn from it. But again, Jesse and Tess didn't really do anything wrong in this situation. So 1 John chapter 3, if you want to turn over there. So if you can tell from that tonight, I kind of want to talk about being there for each other and not abandoning our brothers and sisters. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 17. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? And then Matthew chapter 25, starting in verse 35. This is Jesus talking here. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these brothers, you did it to me. So from these passages, obviously, we're supposed to be there for our brothers and sisters in Christ, and really anyone in this world, everyone is our neighbor. We read that in the New Testament. And so by doing that, as we see Jesus talking about here, that's really serving God and honoring him and worshiping him in that way. So looking at the story again, I think there's a pretty basic cliche type of application to take out of the beginning is different paths in our lives. So going down the river, when those little reed island things come up, there's different paths you can take. And a lot of times in our lives, we see these different paths. Something might be look cool, might be look fun, and we get in a position where it's not very wise of us. And I think that's what it comes down to, is having wisdom in those situations. A certain situation, again, might not be a sin necessarily, but it's not wise to put yourself in that place. And so that's when problems come up. And so I didn't see those rocks until I was right upon them. I couldn't see them because they were below the surface. So a lot of those problems that catch up with us come at the last second, and we can't see those because they're below the surface. So making sure we put ourselves in the right situations, surround us by the right people, not putting ourselves in places that can easily trip us up. And that comes back to the devil being sneaky. And a lot of times I think we underestimate Satan and think that we know what his next move is, and we know how, and we feel confident. And a lot of times we need to reevaluate and realize that he's a lot more sneaky than we give him credit for, and he can really trip us up sometimes. Another application is being the first responders as Christians. A lot of times we see these natural disasters on the television, on the news, and we get all this praise, give all this praise to the first responders, the policemen, the firemen who are there first, and being there for the people when they needed it most. And as Christians, we need to be first responders too. I think, at least for myself, a lot of times I'll see maybe or hear about a brother or sister struggling, and I think to myself, well, I'm not close as this person, or I'm not family like this other person, or I might not feel as qualified as somebody else to help that person out. But we need to throw those things away and realize that we're all struggling with different things and we can all relate. And even if we get to that person and we ask them what's going on and we can't help them, we can direct them to somebody else or have someone else come and come to their aid at that time. So we need to be first responders as Christians. Proverbs chapter 27. Proverbs 27 verse 10. Do not forsake your friend or your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away. So again, being near to each other to help each other out, and then not abandoning that brother or sister. A lot of times we might come up to a brother and ask them what's going on and give them an ear to talk to, but then we just think that we did our job and we go away and, okay, I helped that brother out by listening to him. Now he's got it on his own. We can't abandon each other. We need to keep checking up. And even when a brother or sister has kind of conquered this trial in their lives, a lot of times we now take that upon ourselves. Well, now I can leave them alone. And that's, again, wrong. We need to keep up to date with each other and make sure that we're always accountable for each other. And so because of that, we really should never abandon anyone. We're talking about loving our neighbor and that type of thing. And so I think that we see in the scripture that abandoning is something that as Christians we need to stay completely away from. And then looking at my paddle floating away in the story, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 11. I kind of look at the paddle that floated away kind of like God's word, scripture. So in that position, I was kind of stressed out. My kayak was overflowing with water, and I was not worried about my paddle. I kind of let that go down the river because I wasn't thinking about that. I was stressed out about other things. And then I realized once I got back in the boat, I couldn't do anything really with my paddle. It could have been a lot worse. And so comparing that to God's word, let's read Deuteronomy 11, verse 18. You shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your house, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. And it goes on to talk about God's word, and we see that throughout the Bible about how important this word is. And whether we're in a position that's a time in our lives that's maybe things are going well for us or things that are going bad, we always need to make sure that we're keeping God in the forefront of our minds and reading and meditating on his word. And then finally, in that story, Jesse and Tess kind of expected me to catch up, I think. And that was right of them because it wasn't that big of a deal. But in our lives as Christians, if something is really a problem, I think, at least for me and I think other people, we expect somebody to kind of pick themselves up. And so we see somebody struggling and we just in our head think, well, they're just going through a rut or they're going just kind of through a down period of their life and they'll be over it in a couple months and they'll be fine. God put us on this earth together to help each other as brothers and sisters, and we shouldn't be isolated as Christians in this world. So we can't expect each other to work things out by themselves. We need to constantly, again, not abandon each other, be checking up on each other, and making sure that we're doing the things that we need to. And so in conclusion, I just want to leave us with kind of three summarizing points. So first is we have to be willing to ask for help, first of all. A lot of times it comes down to maybe pride. You don't want to ask others. Maybe you feel burdensome and don't want to put that on somebody else. But I remember my dad, when I was younger, talking to me a lot about how we're supposed to be servants and that's good of us, but we need something to do as service. And sometimes it might be kind of hard to figure out, well, what can I do to serve others? There might be a lull in activity at your congregation or at school that there might not be as many service opportunities at certain points. So that's when you need someone to step up and ask for help. And so my dad would tell me that person is doing a service by asking for help, because we're, as Christians, our duty is to help and serve others. And if we can't do that, then we're not doing our duty. And so we need to take away our pride and realize that we need to ask others for help and give others the opportunity to serve us as well. Second, we need to constantly discuss spiritual things. Something that can be kind of awkward, especially for me, kind of younger, not as experienced. I know I get very uncomfortable sometimes talking to people about spiritual things, but to realize that after that conversation is over, I'm sure we've all experienced that we feel better about it. Even though we might have approached that conversation and felt it was going to be awkward, and maybe it was awkward for the first couple minutes, I know when somebody's approached me and asked me how I'm doing spiritually, after that conversation, I feel great, and I feel encouraged, and I feel like somebody cares about me. And so to realize that and not get discouraged and try to stay in our comfort zone a lot, and I think we need to get out of that. And then finally, the overarching kind of theme of the lesson, just don't abandon your brother. Make sure that we're accountable towards each other and always asking how we're doing spiritually and physically with anything in our lives. We need to be there for each other. And then, again, not to abandon each other, but to keep up. So that's what I had for tonight. Hopefully we can take something out of that. If you're here tonight and you need to do one of those things I just talked about and ask for help from the congregation here, if you need something, you're struggling with something that we can help you with, we'd love to hear that and we'd love to be able to serve you in that capacity. Also, if you're wanting to be baptized tonight and put on the name of Christ, we'd encourage that as well. Really, if there's anything we can do here to serve you tonight, we'd encourage you to come to the front as we stand and sing.